starring Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., also starring Philip Abbott, Stephen Brooks, Lynn Loring, with guest stars Jeffrey Hunter, Estelle Winwood, and special guest star Dean Amaro. Tonight's episode, The Monster.
Well, that's the introduction and theme song to the FBI television series that ran from 1965 to 1974, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to examine important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And I remember watching some of those episodes from the FBI as a kid in reruns where square-jawed, clean-cut men defended truth, justice, and the American way. And today we want to talk about the FBI with liberty activist Chris Wright, who is a leader of the Potomac Tea Party, a national tea party based here in Northern Virginia. And he has recently undertaken a Freedom of Information Act FOIA request concerning the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, to examine just what exactly does the FBI know about threats from Islamic doctrines such as Sharia and jihad, and to examine what sort of materials do they have in their training or their threat assessments. So here to talk about this issue is Chris Wright. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for having me, and thanks for the theme music. Brings back memories. I remember watching that show when I was a kid. I should mention, however, that I'm not here today wearing my Potomac Tea Party hat. I'm here today wearing my Sharia Tip Sheet hat, my own personal website, liberato.us, L-I-B as in boy, E-R-A-T as in Tom, O.us, liberato.us, and that's and I've undertaken this Freedom of Information Act case against the FBI on my own as a personal project.
Yes, and indeed you've been running the Sharia Tip Sheet and since 2012 at your website, Liberato. And so this is an issue you've really been following. Well, discuss your FOIA lawsuit that you've undertaken on your own with the FBI.
Okay, I filed this case 3.5 years ago. The process starts where you send a Freedom of Information Act request to the agency, in this case the FBI. They have something like 20 working days to respond, and as happened in my FOIA cases before, the agency did not respond, so I filed suit in federal court for the District of Columbia, District Court for the District of Columbia. It got assigned to a judge, and it's been going. The wheels of justice grind slowly, so this case has been going for 3.5 years, but it's winding to a conclusion because, as ordinarily happens in these cases, there is no trial, really. Everything's done on motions and papers, and what's supposed to happen is the parties are supposed to get together, see what they can agree to, narrow the issues for the court, and then at some point the government says, we're done, and they file a motion for summary judgment, and the plaintiff in this case me, opposes that if the plaintiff thinks there's more to get under the Freedom of Information Act and existing doctrines. So it's been going for 3.5 years. The government has filed its motion for summary judgment. I've filed an opposition, and the government has a couple more weeks to respond to that, and then I get the last word 2 weeks after that. So this is coming to a head.
All right, so 3.5 years. Now, summary judgment, as those of us with legal backgrounds, I mean, both you and I have gone to law school, and you even practiced law for a while, I believe. Summary judgment is a motion that you try to party will try to dismiss the entire case by going to the judge and saying, even if you take everything in favor of the opposing party, in this case a plaintiff, you still cannot win given the law and the facts that you presented. There's just no way you can win, so we should have a summary judgment and just dismiss this case. You say this is the usual practice in these requests that you've done. What then usually happens in summary judgments? You ultimately come to some sort of arbitration where the FBI, the judge, will make a decision that, yeah, the FBI has to release this or this material or within these parameters.
It's very common for judges at that point to say to grant summary judgment in part and deny it in part and order the agency to make additional disclosures, and that's the way a lot of these cases go. I have no idea what will go on in this case because, as they say in the law, litigation, anything can happen. I've won cases I should have lost when I was practicing, and I lost cases I should have won. And so I'm a retired attorney now, and I'm doing this as what they call a pro se plaintiff. I'm doing this without legal representation. I'm representing myself.
Well, so that, yeah, and of course, we are talking about going before a judge here, not a jury trial. I guess you would never have a jury trial in a FOIA lawsuit or, I mean, I don't know if anyone wants or if that's ever occurred. Well, what other FOIA information lawsuits have you undertaken in the past?
One was about Obamacare, and I did another one. I think it was the if you remember the unaccompanied alien children surge of, I think it was 2014 during the Obama administration. I got a lot of information about the shelters, and it's actually kind of interesting to go back and look at the report now, which is on still posted on Liberato.us, because these issues are back, as we know, under the Biden administration.
Well, I guess one general question as well, thinking of these FOIA requests, what is sort of the process involved, you know, what sort of costs are involved and so forth? And you've talked about here you've had 3.5 years, you know, how available is this for just any citizen to exercise this means to find out what their government's doing? And how often does it end in, like, lawsuits like this? Are there ever occasions where an agency just comes forward and says, yeah, okay, we'll give you whatever you want?
That happens sometimes, and there's even a fairly new development where agencies are putting stuff out in like some kind of library site and saying, well, we know Freedom of Information Act requests are coming, so we'll just put out everything now and save everybody the trouble. So there's some of that going on now, too.
Uh-huh, but is this then, could you, I guess, is this a costly process? I guess if you don't get a lawsuit, maybe it's easy to do, but I guess the real cost then comes in if you get challenged, then you got to go to court.
Well, there's no cost to filing these requests with the agency, but if they don't respond or if you're not happy with their response, and then your only recourse is to file a case, and if you want to file a case in federal court, when I filed mine, this one 3.5 years ago, it cost me $400. That's just the filing fee. So maybe it's gone up since then. I don't know. I haven't filed another one since then, but it's a chunk of change.
Well, that's interesting. Just the file is $400, and then the whole issue of representation. I mean, in your case, you've got a legal background, so you can do pro se yourself without any consultation. But indeed, yeah, that is a indeed a significant fee. So you really want to think if you have something valuable to go after. Very interesting. That's.
Well, if you do have something valuable, to go after, maybe the best course of action for your listeners to consider is to find a legal institute, a legal foundation. They file these cases routinely, and if they like your issue and the information you're trying to get, maybe you can find a legal foundation to take up your case.
Yeah, indeed. I guess I was thinking there one group that would come to mind would be Judicial Watch. Judicial Watch here in Washington, D.C., led by Tom Fitton. They've done a lot of FOIA requests on all manner of issues, some of them also involving these issues of Islamic doctrine and what the government knows about it, is doing about it. So, yeah, that's one avenue you might approach there. Well, how did you come upon this idea of looking at the FBI and what they know about any Islamic threat doctrine?
Well, having looked at this subject since at least 2012, and I had prior background that took college courses on it when 9/11 happened, I read 4 more books, came to the same conclusions, and in talking to anti-Sharia activists over the years, there's just this huge disconnect between the way grassroots activists look at this subject versus the way the Washington establishment does, or the deep state, or whatever you want to call it, because the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the Pentagon in its current form, The whole Washington establishment, and I heard Senator Dick Durbin say much the same thing. They're all lined up behind this idea that anything about terrorist attacks or jihad or Sharia supremacy, world domination, all that stuff is a perversion of Islam, and that standard Islamic doctrine, real Islam, isn't anything like that. Well, that's completely contrary. You open up the Quran to just about any page, and you're going to see jihad. You're going to see Sharia supremacy. It's all replete all the way through the doctrine. I found one site that did a count, and it was 164 times the Quran says in various ways, slay the infidel. I've seen other counts ranging from 100 and up. 164 is the highest I've seen. So there's a little bit of interpretation there, but the point remains the same. It's just about everywhere, anywhere you look in Islamic doctrine. So we've got this huge disconnect between what the Washington establishment, how they view Islam, and how anti-Sharia activists and anybody who does a plain reading of the doctrine of the Quranic scripture and passages and the way they view Islam. It's our contention, my contention, and I share it with many others, that standard Islamic doctrine is the problem. It hasn't been hijacked by extremists. All this stuff about jihad and subversion of existing national governments, Sharia supremacy, all of that stuff is standard. It's mainstream. It's like President Erdogan of Turkey said in 2017, there is no moderate Islam or extremist Islam. Islam is Islam, and I agree with that, because if you look at the standard doctrine as I have, and I quote numerous passages in my latest court filing, you can see it on just about any page. There it is, right for you, for anybody to see. And it's not a matter of interpretation. It's a plain reading of the words that are there on the pages. And there are even admissions from Islamic scholars in Indonesia, India, and I found another one. Let's see, where was that? Oh, that was Egypt. They know they have a problem because these scholars will admit, yep, it's there. It's right there in mainstream doctrine. In fact, Egypt, I find this very interesting, they have outlawed the teaching of certain Quranic passages because those passages advocate terrorism. So if Egypt knows they've got a problem, maybe the FBI should take another look, and maybe the Washington establishment should take another look and admit that there's a problem here.
Yeah, and indeed, these filings, that these court documents, these filings you have, again, are posted on your website at Liberato, so people there can go online, liberato.us, and they can read these court documents you have and follow these arguments you've outlined at considerable length in these documents. Well, what has the FBI's response been to your FOIA request? What sort of arguments have they made?
Well, they did give me thousands of pages. And the first thing they did was give me 1,000 pages in response to some other case, some other FOIA request, and dumped it on me and said, here, wade through this. We think you might like it. So I view that as a tactic to start wearing me down, 1,000 pages from another case. Then they were ordered by the court to produce 500 pages a month, and that went on for about a year and a half. I did get 500 pages a month. The problem is, none of it was very interesting for my purposes. They gave me basically two items of interest. One was a number of training courses where they make the claim and they're training their agents and they're teaching their agents and all their personnel that all this stuff about terrorism and jihad and Sharia supremacy, that's a perversion of Islam, it's an interpretation, and that real Islam isn't anything like that. So that's what the FBI is training its people. The other document that is of interest is a letter from the Justice Department talking about how the current generation of supposed counterterrorism training, which is called Countering Violent Extremism, CVE, there's a little backstory I'll tell you in a minute on that, that it's not really counterterrorism training. So here's what happened. The FBI had a set of trainers and training materials before 2011, that talked about all these things that I'm talking about in standard Islamic doctrine. Then along comes the Obama administration, John Brennan. There was a 57 group coalition letter signed by CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations, and 56 others saying, get rid of that stuff. So they did, and they got rid of standard counterterrorism training, and they got rid of all but one of the trainers that was teaching it. And then they introduced something called Countering Violent Extremism, CVE, which homogenizes and puts everything in a blender and says every threat is like every other threat. So a white supremacist threat is just like a jihadi threat, and so animal rights activists and people who put nails in trees and animal rights activists who spray paint on mink coats, they're all equal, which is preposterous. So you're telling me that the people who flew the planes into the buildings in 9/11 are the same threat as animal rights activists? That's just preposterous. But anyway, that's the way our government has gone. CVE is still their curriculum to this day. And the letter from the Justice Department I referenced a minute ago said, oh, well, CVE is not really counterterrorism training. It's just a community engagement strategy. Okay, so in my view, here's what happened. We went from standard counterterrorism training, where Islam was the doctrine was recognized as a threat, and we named the enemy. We went from that to CVE, Countering Violent Extremism, which is a watered-down version of counterterrorism training that mixes everything up and mushes everything together and makes everything unclear. And then we went from that to the Justice Department letter that says, well, that's only a community engagement strategy. So we went from counterterrorism training to mush to no counterterrorism training at all. That seems to be what has happened with our federal government. And part of what's got me going here is there was a book written by Diana West called American Betrayal. Starts off with communism in the federal government. Before the McCarthy era, going all the way back to the 20s and 30s, traces it up through the McCarthy era, and then goes on to say the modern-day stuff that's going on with Islam in the federal government is part and parcel of the same thing. So one of my major themes now and going forward will be the ideological subversion of the federal government, because I think that's what we've got here. I don't know how you account for people who are at the head of these agencies not recognizing or not wanting to recognize that Islamic doctrine is a threat, and they go around saying that white supremacy is the biggest threat we face, and they're cooking the books on that, and that's another subject for another day. But for them to put the blinders on and say, well, Islam's not a threat, it's just preposterous to me. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so you found then in what the FBI is giving you, you found no sort of discussion of any such Islamic threat doctrines like jihad or Sharia, equivalent to what you might expect precisely for, like, white supremacy. I mean, you know, we have in American society, you know, all this discussion of, like, you know, what are white supremacist signs and symbols, like, is the OK symbol now a white supremacist sign, and, you know, or what is, you know, like, 488 apparently is some sort of, represents some sort of slogan about Adolf Hitler or something, I forget, you know, and, you know, but, you know, all these signs, like, you know, we're supposed to be on the lookout and, you know, for who's a white supremacist and what are they saying and, you know, is the Confederate battle flag, does that signal white supremacy or, you know, what's the ideology or, you know, do we need to rip down Confederate statues? But you haven't found any discussion of any such similar ideology in the FBI documents that you received on jihad or Sharia.
Well, I don't want to leave the wrong impression. There still is training, and they still teach about Al-Qaeda. They still teach about Islamic State, IS, or ISIS, as people still call it. They still teach about radicalization. They've taken some heat for still teaching about radicalization, the signs of when somebody's being radicalized. But the envelope that they put it all in is, it's not real Islam. It's a perversion of Islam. These groups are perverting Islam. They're giving you some their own idiosyncratic interpretation of Islam, and real Islam is not like that. That's the problem, because real Islam is like that. I'm telling you, open up the Quran any page, you'll see the problem right there.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, according to that policy, then this Taliban group that is now taking over Afghanistan, that is frustrated and borne out in the American-led efforts to try to create some sort of stable, non-Taliban, non-jihadist government in Afghanistan. Now we see, you know, all the people fleeing Afghanistan, and the American planes are taking off with this withdrawal. But according then to the FBI, the Taliban is not real Islam.
I don't recall in all the hundreds and thousands of pages I got whether there was any training on the Taliban specifically, but if they treat it like they treat the other groups, their approach would be, yeah, they're doing all this stuff, and yeah, they're a threat, but it's not real Islam. That would be their approach. Now, what the FBI, the interesting parts, they're hiding the ball. They're not giving me the interesting parts if they exist. So what they did was, you asked a while ago, what did they give me, and what I described, laid all that out to you, some hundreds and thousands of pages. But what they didn't give me was an answer to my question as to whether or not the FBI has ever considered whether Islamic doctrine in and of itself is a threat to national security and law enforcement. If it is, if they have considered it, I want to know if there's been a record made of that discussion. And if there's a record made of that discussion, I want to know if they'll give it to me. In fact, I offered to settle this whole case, which I made very complicated for myself because I included 15 items with multiple subparts. At one point, when we were supposed to be narrowing the issues for the court, I offered to the FBI that they settle the entire case. I would settle the entire case for an answer to those three questions. Have they ever considered whether Islamic doctrine is a threat in and of itself? If so, is there a record of the discussion? And if so, can I have the record? You know what they did after that, Andrew? Once the heart of the case was made clear to them, crystal clear in settlement discussions, you know what they did? They walked away. No counteroffer, no counter discussion, nothing. They walked away. They're hiding the ball now that they see what this is. But they've got a problem because one of the other arguments I make in this case is I mentioned I did 15 separate requests in one. In three of those requests, they took the position that my request about Islamic doctrine being a threat or not being a threat was perfectly reasonably described, a perfectly good FOIA request with respect to counterterrorism training before 2011, counterterrorism training after 2011, and in response to congressional letters of inquiry. All of that was fine. They processed all those requests. So I got their answers with regard to their training before and after, and with regard to at least some of their responses to congressional letters of inquiry. But when we get down to the heart of the case, I also made the same request with the exact same wording, the exact same verbiage, with respect to all other non-training records. You know what they did, Andrew? They came back and they said, oops, not reasonably described. Which I just find just amazing. So it's okay for one, door number one. It's okay for door number two. It's okay for door number three. But oops, door number four, all of a sudden, what I'm asking for is not reasonably described. They're hiding the ball, and I've accused them of being in bad faith for this and many other reasons.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you described that again in the documents. It seems like, you know, you can ask for that, you know, regarding letters from Congress to us. But, you know, when you want to get into the really internal discussions of what the FBI is thinking about this, that seems to be like a really sensitive subject, a really hot potato that they don't want to talk about. That's, there's something going on there in the bowels of the FBI, over in that FBI headquarters on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., that, you know, that it's just too hot to handle. They don't want to give out.
Well, here's my position. There was a previous case, Islamic Shura Council versus FBI, where they didn't want to make a sensitive disclosure. And so what they did in that case was that they said, well, we, the FBI, get to make this decision as to whether or not we're going to disclose something. And the Ninth Circuit, of all places, and the trial court in that case came back and said, That's a violation of separation of powers. Get back in your lane. You don't get to make this decision. The courts do. And that's what the Freedom of Information Act says, and that's what's supposed to happen here. So they used a subterfuge to avoid making a sensitive disclosure in that case. Now, what they did in my case was, we don't want to make a sensitive disclosure, and we're going to use a different subterfuge because the one we were using previously got knocked down. So we're going to use the subterfuge of turning away your request by saying it's not reasonably described. But to my way of thinking, form over substance is the same thing. It's a subterfuge. They don't want to make this disclosure. They want to arrogate to themselves the power to make this final decision. But as I've argued in my pleading here, it's not their decision to make, and I'm asking the court to fulfill its proper role and take command of the situation, and the court make this decision. I don't care if the FBI doesn't want to make a sensitive disclosure here. It's not up to them. It's up to the courts.
Well, this is discussing all these legal issues. Has anyone else thought of doing this with the IRS? I mean, I think of, for example, the Stephen Muse and David Yaroshalmi at the American Freedom Law Center. Have they ever conducted any such requests of the FBI?
I don't know the answer to that question, but as far as I'm aware, I'm the only one in the country forcing the issue about standard Islamic doctrine in any way. I've heard a lot of people talk about it over the years, but I'm the only one who's trying to force the issue, and I'm using the Freedom of Information Act to do it.
Yeah, indeed, to really pin down the government and say, hey, well, you know, what are you talking about on this issue? Well, you talked about this 2011 purge of FBI training materials led by, as you say, some 57 Muslim American organizations, led by Muslim advocates. This Muslim American legal organization has some background to, you know, connections to various sort of Muslim Brotherhood-aligned groups. What have you mentioned in your filings, trainers, people involved with the FBI before, like Sebastian Gorka and Stephen Coughlin, who were purged from FBI training materials. Have you talked with them about their experiences with the FBI?
Without naming names, I will tell you that over the years, and not specifically in reference to this case, I have talked to more than one of them.
And what do they relate? What was the change like, or what were they told, or how did that happen at the FBI?
Well, they were standard counterterrorism trainers. Of course, they're appalled by being thrown out. But as far as I'm aware, none of them did anything to try to force the issue. I don't know that they did that. I mean, these people have gone on to do good work. I mean, Sebastian Gorka has his radio show. Stephen Coughlin has his Unconstrained Analytics website where he keeps putting out great material on this and other subjects. But as far as I'm aware, nobody, aside from me, has tried to force the issue in any way.
And have they been able to release or make public, or have you been able to access any of these previous training materials, and do you notice a fundamental difference between what the FBI is doing today?
I'm trying to recall the differences between – I made this huge catalog of the training programs they gave me, which were before and after the introduction of CVE. And CVE is a whole lot more touchy-feely, that kind of thing. But it's still the same. And what goes on in those programs is what I expressed to you before about how it's a perversion of Islam to think about jihad and Sharia supremacy and those kinds of things. Now, one of my 15 requests, this is kind of interesting. This is why I think they're another reason I think they're in bad faith. One of my requests was I wanted records where they discussed such books as, I don't know how to pronounce this name, Qutb, Qutb's Milestones, and Stephen Coughlin's catastrophic failure, the willful blindness of government agencies, and a few other book titles. They came back and they said, well, we did a search and we didn't come up with any records. Now here's the problem. And this is an amazing thing that they're still doing this. Because I read quite a bit about their search methods and what they were doing. And I found out that since at least 2009, when they got a request they didn't like, they would search what they call the index of the Central Record System, CRS Index Searching. Well, that's the problem, because the CRS index is like a library, old-fashioned library card catalog on paper. It's not all the information in the library, because it's not all the information in the books. It's just the information that people put on card catalogs. And in the FBI's case, they do it for their own investigative purposes. So it's cases, it's people, it's places, and it's events. There is no way they're going to index book titles. Now, there was a previous case that was decided before they filed their that said to the FBI, somebody would ask them for all records regarding a certain documentary, and the documentary didn't have anything to do with Islam. It just the name of it, I'll tell you this name. I have no idea what the documentary is about. The name of it, the title of it is Cowspiracy. What a great name. I have no idea what it means. So anyway, the court said, well, FBI, that's very nice that you searched your index, but it was designed to fail. Your search was designed to fail. You don't get to do what you want to do. You're going to do what the court is going to tell you to do. And the court then ordered them to do a keyword search, just like everybody does on Google every day, a keyword search for documents relating to Cowspiracy. And I put that in my pleading also. There is no material difference between a book title and a film title, is there? So they should go back and do a keyword search for all these book titles, including Stephen Coughlin's book, Catastrophic Failure, and give me the records that somewhere, somehow, they have to have discussed these major works. And if a keyword search would fish that out.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the CRS, the Central Record Service, sort of like about activities, whereas a keyword search would involve, you know, just anything. I mean, any book title, movie title, whatever that has been discussed. And indeed, you would want to know, you know, what's the bibliography, the reading list of the FBI. Like, are they reading Robert Spencer or Stephen Coughlin or, Ibn Warraq, or are they reading, you know, Edward Said, on the other hand, you know, leftist like that, or Karen Armstrong, all these, you know, apologists for Islam or something. That itself, just find out what's the reading material of the FBI would be a really key indicator of what they're thinking.
That's an interesting idea for another FOIA request. I'm going to make a note. Thanks for suggesting it.
Well, that's it. Yeah. You know, you could run the whole like sort of bibliographical gamut, you know, and find out sort of what leaning they have, you know, if they're spending all their time reading, you know, Karen Armstrong or Craig Considine or John Esposito over at Georgetown University, where you went to law school, you know, that would give you one idea of what they're thinking. Whereas on the other hand, you know, if they're not reading Robert Spencer, if they are reading Robert Spencer, that, you know, that would give you an idea of what their ideological balance is. So that strikes me as an idea there.
It's a good idea. I'll put that in the hopper. And it fits with this theme that I'm going to be pursuing going forward, the ideological subversion of the U.S. government. I'm concerned that this is taking place.
Well, and have you been able to talk with any people associated with the FBI in recent years since 2011, since its purge, any like retired FBI officers or even people still with the FBI off the record who've discussed their experiences with what has happened to their threat doctrine development in the FBI on these issues?
Let's see. How much should I tip here? Well, I'm not in touch with anybody who currently works for the FBI, but over the years and in various ways, I have talked to people retired from the FBI.
Mm-hmm. And have they had any interesting insights you could share, or is that has to remain off the record?
Nothing I can really share. I will tell you that for my purposes, for the purposes of this case, unfortunately, a lot of that was less interesting than I had hoped it would be. So I'm not even sure that they have thought about things in the terms that I'm thinking about them.
Well, you talk about here this wider theme going beyond the FBI of ideological subversion, you know, what people might call information warfare of trying to shape people's ideological perceptions of various issues. Well, what has been involved with that at the FBI and other institutions of the government? Have they succumbed to such information warfare, and how has that happened?
Well, if you've got somebody like a John Brennan, who I think he was at the White House at the time, he started the ball rolling on this changeover from standard counterterrorism training to the watered-down version called CVE. If it goes from there to, I think it was Robert Mueller, who was in charge of the FBI at the time, and you get those types of people, and then you get Diana West writing another book about how a lot of these people have communist connections in some way, like James Comey writing something when he was a student at William & Mary, and the story goes on from there. I think there's and then you think about this whole charade that's going on with white supremacy and them cooking the books and cooking up this whole thing to deflect attention from other threats. I think the chances are very high that what we have is a Washington establishment, large parts of which no longer believe in America's founding principles and believe in something else at this point. And I think that it's something that I want to pursue going forward, to document that if it's true, and to try to do something about it, because we can't survive as a country if the ruling elite, if you will, no longer believes in the underpinnings of the country. So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, indeed. Well, and you mentioned this theme, and many people have talked about this issue of you know, is white supremacy, I guess it's been said by like the Biden administration, that this is the greatest domestic terrorism threat. Is that a comparison to jihad threats? Is that really true? I mean, what's the balance between these threats here?
Indeed, that's the question. What's the balance between the threats? And I'm not an expert on the white supremacy literature about this threat, but I only know a few things. I'll throw out a few factoids here. Everything they do to make that case starts after 9/11, so they don't have to count the 3,000 people who died that day. Another thing they do is they emphasize the year 2018, because there was a lot of white supremacist activity that year compared to other years. So they cook the books in various ways. What's interesting is, in my case, one of my items was to ask for records concerning the Bridges program. It's some kind of touchy-feely community outreach program that the FBI has, and in Detroit it was run by a Muslim woman, and this was all written up and reported and is publicly known. And one of the things that came out of a meeting that was attended by somebody that you and I both know and then was written up, this is also public, so this is, I won't hide this ball from you, was written up by Leo Homan. You must know that name. One of the things this woman said was that they were going to use white supremacy as a way to deflect attention away from Muslims and Islam. Well, that's a pretty bold statement, isn't it? And I should also mention, you'll like this. Okay, so this woman, she's Muslim. She does this community outreach program in Detroit, or at least she did. I don't know if she's still there. But it was this line that you must have heard many times about how they will say that jihad is just a spiritual struggle. You've heard that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so what she says was, so in my case, that means that I have to struggle against eating too much cheesecake. So that's what jihad is. Jihad is a struggle against eating too much cheesecake. And one of the points I make in my pleading is, okay, this woman is not out there saying these things on her own. She was put there, and she must have cleared all of this with her superiors, and so that it's a matter of FBI policy somehow, some way that got made, that FBI representatives are out there saying jihad is just a struggle against eating too much cheesecake. Now, in this particular instance, I think there's more bad faith here, is because their answer was, after I asked for the records, they came back and said, well, we searched the community relations office and we didn't find any records. Well, there wouldn't be any records in the community relations office because that's not where the decisions would have been made about all these policy issues about white supremacy and jihad being cheesecake, et cetera, et cetera. Those decisions would have been made in like the counterterrorism division or some kind of leadership office or something like that. So what we have here is another designed-to-fail search. Designed-to-fail. They search the community relations office and there are no records. Well, I'm asking the court to decide my way on that point and compel them to search leadership offices and the counterterrorism division and find out so that I can find out where these decisions were made and what the policies are.
So in that case, then, to find out, you know, what is the doctrinal understanding of the FBI of jihad, do they really think it's just a spiritual struggle to do things like, you know, not eat too much cheesecake, or do they also have an understanding of jihad as really, you know, militant warfare to subjugate non-Muslims?
Well, it is. If you're off to the extreme and you're off to some group, some fringe group that has perverted Islam and it's not real Islam, then of course there's jihad, and these groups have these kinds of doctrines, but they're fringe groups, they're extremists, they can be dismissed. It's not real Islam. See the problem? See what they've done here?
Yeah, that's a distinct emphasis, really putting it off as something that just doesn't really have any basic support within the faith and would then have any significant following, which is something I guess we're discovering once again to our regret that in Afghanistan that's not true. I mean, there, jihad does not mean reducing your consumption of cheesecake. It means something else among the Taliban.
I cite at least a dozen passages from the Quran in my pleading. Let me just read two of them to you. Make war on them until idolatry shall cease and God's religion shall reign supreme. Quran 8:40. I shall cast terror into the hearts of the infidels, strike off their heads and strike off the very tips of their fingers. Quran 8:12. Now I ask you, Andrew, is it I love this term, literal interpretation, which to me is an oxymoron. How can you have a literal interpretation? To me, a plain reading of these passages tells you that they have standard doctrines, mainstream doctrines, religious obligations imposed on every Muslim to carry forth jihad and Sharia supremacy. There's the problem. It's not tacked on later by fringe groups. It's not tacked on later by extremists. It's not some kind of interpretation. It's the doctrine. That's the problem. And that's what I'm trying to force, and that's what I'm trying to get. If we're going to conclude that all this stuff, passages like this, are not a threat to national security and law enforcement, if we're going to decide that as a country, shouldn't we at least have a discussion about it first? That's my point.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that seems to be a very important debate, a very important discussion to have, and it's not something that you can just sort of hide in some back room, you know, smoke-filled room, as the saying goes, and not, you need to have more of an open debate. I mean, that's like dealing with, say, fundamental doctrine in the Cold War. Like, what are we going to do in the Cold War with respect to the Soviet Union? And, you know, what's our approach going to be there towards communism or something? That's not something that we can just shunt off to a back room there. Well, you mentioned, you know, this whole idea about cheesecake, I mean, and jihad. I mean, that brings up this whole idea. You, of course, recall years ago, about a decade ago, more than a decade ago, you know, the Council on American Islamic Relations had this whole My Jihad campaign, you know, these posters that would say, like, you know, like making friends across the aisle is my jihad, or, you know, working out at the gym despite my busy schedule is my jihad. Again, all this personal, spiritual struggle. But the FBI is supposed to not supposed to have discontinued contact with CARE, I believe, back in 2009 because of its background as a Hamas front organization and links to terrorism advocacy. Has the FBI been upholding that policy? In some of your pleadings, it seems like they've had some continuing interaction with CARE.
Well, unfortunately, you're quite right. Back in I think it was 2009, if I'm recalling correctly, because of the Holy Land Foundation trial and the evidence that was adduced in that trial, the FBI cut off contact with CARE. But here's the problem. There have that doesn't seem to be the case today. They seem to have resumed. I don't know with CARE specifically, but and I'm forgetting the guy's name. I think his first name was Dennis. But anyway, there was some FBI official a couple of years ago that went out to the 9/11 mosque in the Washington D.C. area. And he went there for a program, and he gave a little speech, and everybody clapped, and you know, and so now the FBI and the Muslims there are all good buddies. So no, the policy that they adopted in 2009 is not the current policy. It's been reversed in very significant ways.
Yeah, I guess you're speaking of the Dar al-Hijra Mosque, which is here in Northern
Virginia. That's the one.
Yeah.
False Church.
Yeah, it's in Northern Virginia, out here in an area called Seven Corners. And they actually have various open houses. I actually went to one about 6 years ago and stopped by. But there, that was where, for example, a couple of the hijackers of 9/11 had gone to mosque there, as well as Anwar al-Awlaki was an imam there who was later droned, as they say, by the CIA in Yemen with a Hellfire missile for being an al-Qaeda member, a propagandist for al-Qaeda, who was killed there. So a mosque that has had all sorts of nefarious connections. So, yeah, not the place you'd necessarily want the FBI to have as an active partner, the Dar al-Hijra Mosque. In Northern Virginia, Seven Corners area.
Well, this is why I keep coming back to this phrase, the ideological subversion of the U.S. government. I am very worried about it. And when you look at the people in the Washington establishment who are running around like chickens with their heads cut off about white supremacy, and nobody wants to talk about the threat from standard Islamic doctrine anymore, I wonder, what happened? Were they bought? Were they bought off? Were their families threatened? Do they really hate this country that much? What accounts for this behavior? I don't know, but in years going forward, I'd like to do my best to find out.
Yeah, and that brings up an interesting argument. Thinking of FBI history, I mean, you bring up Diana West and her book on American betrayal and this analogy, this comparison between, pro-jihadist forces, propagandists in the United States today sort of influencing, subverting American governmental institutions like the FBI. And in the past, you had this wave of, pro-communist individuals, American communists, and even people who were Soviet spies who had infiltrated the American government in the 1930s and 1940s during World War II, and where, people like Harry Dexter White, later found out to be a Soviet spy, were involved in, or Alger Hiss, at key policy-making levels in the American government. As well as you also have the controversy over under J. Edgar Hoover, he later really focused on communism in the 1950s, but, really thought that, organized crime with the mafia wasn't such a big deal. But in both of these cases, if you're talking about communists on the one hand or organized crime on the other hand, the mafia, you're talking about transnational threats. I mean, the mafia, Italian organized crime, has its original base in Italy and Sicily, and communism has its base in foreign countries like the Soviet Union or, for that matter, China or the Soviet bloc. So, you're dealing with phenomena that are different from white supremacy, which is basically just a domestic phenomenon. But then, jihadists as well, we're talking about the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, jihadist states like the Islamic Republic of Iran. You know, this is a whole transnational threat. So it's really strange to there's a fundamental difference between white supremacy, this purely domestic, small domestic threat, and this really all-embracing transnational threat.
Well, you make a good point, and my filing was due at the end of the week where Afghanistan collapsed, so I managed to include saying that my question about standard Islamic doctrine is made all the more urgent by the collapse of Afghanistan, and I did include a couple of the early articles that appeared right after the collapse from national security experts who are worried about what might be coming across the border. Our unsealed, unclosed, open, porous southern border. Okay, so now they've got all this American military hardware. They hate America. Are they going to come here and take revenge? I don't know. These are questions worth asking. So you're making a good point. What happened in Afghanistan is not necessarily going to stay in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up issues. I mean, you talk about the border now, you know, talking about transnational threats, you know, it's not going to be white supremacists crossing that border that, as we've seen under President Joe Biden, is not really being defended or maintained. You know, once again, is really having a lot of open border porous holes in it again. You know, J. Michael Waller, a person whom we both know, also talked about how after the fall of South Vietnam in 1975, you had all this American equipment there. And then a lot of that, you know, like M16s that fell into the hands of the communist government in Hanoi, that wound up late in later decades, you know, in Central America, Nicaragua with or El Salvador with communist forces there. So, we've got all this military equipment in Afghanistan. We've got to worry, you know, some of that might make its way into the new world and might be coming across our border, maybe like Claymore mines or something like that. So, yeah, that's, again, a transnational issue.
Well, I think one of the early reports was that there were 10,000 U.S. missiles that are now in the hands of the Taliban. So that's a concern also. You know, in one of my earlier cases, the government called me a conspiracy theorist. And so I'm hoping that they make a mistake this time and do something like call me a white supremacist, because that would open the door to put a material in my final pleading about that. And when we're talking about they're running around talking about how white supremacy is the biggest threat, if you lived through the summer of 2020 when for 100 straight nights there was rioting in Portland put on by Antifa types, and Antifa has a cell structure, it's a loosely networked, but they are organized, and they have the capability of putting a pile of bricks on just about any street corner in America in advance of a riot. There is no way that white supremacists in America have that kind of capability. You might have a few wahoos here and there, but they're not organized like Antifa is organized. So this is another reason I say that this whole white supremacy thing, this whole narrative is phony. It's a big phony narrative.
Well, I guess that brings up another angle. I mean, there with Antifa, you know, there's another threat, and indeed that also has certain transnational implications. I mean, you know, maybe not so much as the others, but I mean, certainly, you know, Antifa originally was a German movement. I mean, I recall Antifa from my college days, being an exchange student in Germany. You know, Antifa has always talked about it, and the whole Black Bloc, the Schwarzer Bloc, is a big deal in Germany. But, you know, so you mentioned if you get called a white supremacist, that would open the door for you to ask the FBI about that. That I guess that opens up another interesting angle. Could you do a FOIA request on the FBI to ask, well, what have you studied about white supremacy? What do you know about that? What's your understanding of that threat doctrine? And then you could kind of compare and contrast what the FBI is saying about white supremacy versus jihadist doctrine. And you could sort of see, like, you know, on the one hand, they're really dealing seriously with white supremacy in a concrete manner, but on the other hand, they're always being dismissive about jihadist ideology.
Another good idea, Andrew. Put it in the queue.
Well, I'm glad we're having a fun conversation here. I'm not just being your interviewer. But, you know, that occurred to me. Have you noticed any sort of difference in your FOIA request in the material the FBI is giving you, that anything sort of strikes you, stands out in that way?
Not in that way, because there was only one reference to white supremacy in all the materials, and it was from a public article. It didn't come from any record of the FBI, because the FBI told me that on that point, the Bridges program in Detroit, the meeting, there are no records. So nothing yet.
Boy, you know, that Bridges name is a real common name for all these, Islamic advocacy groups. I mean, you know, of course, at Georgetown University, your law school alma mater, they have the Bridge Initiative against Islamophobia, and in the past there was also in America the Bridges TV that was run by an American Muslim guy who actually ended up beheading his wife and getting arrested for murder. Was promoting moderate Islam and so forth. So that word Bridges, and of course Stephen Coughlin wrote his book Bridge to Nowhere about interfaith efforts among Muslim groups and non-Muslim groups like the Catholic Church, and how that was always just promoting Islamic propaganda. Well, one issue closing out here, have you noticed any difference between the FBI and, say, for example, European police organizations? I mean, in my previous writing, I've analyzed, for example, like the Interpol website, and they have an annual terrorism situation report. And in their terrorism situation reports on terrorism in the European Union, you know, they openly speak about jihadist threats. And indeed, in their recent years, jihadist terrorist threats have been sort of the main threat that they reported on in terms of arrests made, deaths that have occurred, investigations that they've undertaken. I mean, just the amount of material devoted to jihadism is really the most in such reports. Do you notice a difference between the FBI and other organizations like German, police organizations?
Well, I don't know that much about it, but I will tell you that this phrase, countering violent extremism, CVE, did go worldwide, and other countries use it. So I've seen it used in government material and articles about government stuff coming out of Australia and coming out of Europe. So, and it's the people who are writing this stuff, they're all in. They believe in de-radicalization, which has been shown to fail time after time. But they like this name, and I don't know exactly what it means in Europe, but it probably means something, at least something similar to the way it's used here in the United States. And so there's a whole body of literature and academic commotion around CVE in other parts of the world.
Well, okay. Well, closing out here, what do you think deal with these issues? What can Americans like you do in the future to be proactive and try to influence policy at the FBI and other governmental institutions concerning these Islamic doctrinal issues?
Well, I wouldn't start with the FBI. What I would recommend to your listeners is to go to their local sheriff, especially if they're a constitutional sheriff. Go to your local police and find out if there's any interest in receiving training, real training, standard counterterrorism training, because I know people who are ready, willing, and able to offer this training, and they're getting very few takers in places like, Culpeper, Virginia, where there was a training like that scheduled. CARE came, swooped in, and made a big commotion about it. There's a lot of people in law enforcement are shy about receiving the real truth about counterterrorism training and Islamic doctrine. But I know people who are ready, willing, and able to offer that training. So that's what I would suggest to your listeners: contact your local law enforcement and see if they'll get it.
Yeah, indeed. I guess we both met with John Guandolo, who has this understanding of the threat operation. I guess that brings up the question, you know, what other training, again, on issues like white supremacy that police are receiving? So that would be also an interesting comparison to be made there.
Yep.
Well, For our listeners out there, this has been another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod. And we've been talking here today with Chris Wright in his own capacity, who's also a leader of the Potomac Tea Party in Northern Virginia, a national tea party. And he has his own personal website, liberato.us. And he has launched a recent Freedom of Information Act request to examine FBI materials concerning Islamic doctrines on threat doctrines on matters like Sharia and jihad. Well, Chris Wright, thank you for joining the show.
Andrew, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, and for our listeners out there, check out Chris Wright at his website, liberato.us, and join us next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.